Welcome, everybody. This is the Interstate of Music podcast, and I am Jeff Peterson, your host. And with me today, I have, you know, when I got a chance to look at his, basically his LinkedIn profile, his resume, it has every possible business buzzword you could ever imagine as far as what he's done. He's a Forbes contributor. He literally was the co-founder and COO of Beats Music, also the co-founder and CEO of Spotify Business, and now is the founder, CEO, and chair of Soundtrack, your brand. So please welcome to the podcast, Ola Sars. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. I'm here in Stockholm, Sweden, on the other side of the world, and it's dark, and it's late, but I'm pumped up to talk to you.
So Ola, so did you grow up in Sweden and then come to the U.S. for school at Harvard? What was kind of your journey and thought process that got you into the States going to Harvard?
Well, I grew up here in Stockholm, Sweden, but we did move to the U.S. I've been over there a couple of times in my life, actually, on the west side, as I call it. And so as a kid, I moved with the family, actually, to New York. And so we lived there for 3-4 years. And my dad got a job over there. So that was the first kind of tour. And then I went back for some exchange student stuff and kind of high school, and then back for grad school, and jumped out of that to save the world and build the first really good music service, and back working a couple of times, and then ended up on the West Coast with the Beats guys. And that was the last tour over there. I actually didn't move the last time. My family was still, I had two kids at that point. So, we didn't move the family. So I was actually traveling back and forth to the West Coast.
Oh, wow.
In between Stockholm and LA, which wasn't that great. But right. Yes, so multiple visits in your beautiful country throughout my upbringing and growing to an old man.
So when you're looking at, you know, your reasoning for, you know, kind of your career path, your educational path, at that point when you were going to school and you were, you know, kind of making those decisions and coming over to the U.S. as a foreign exchange student and then deciding to, you know, to do the Harvard, you know, go for it kind of a concept, was the music industry part of your thought process, or what were you thinking you were building your educational foundation to do or be?
So 15 years ago, I think 13 or 14 years ago, I started doubting everything I was doing, obviously, and becoming more and more cynical about
I did that last week. I do it right. I do this regularly.
Okay. So every year I become more and more cynical, but then I look up from my desk and see that I am actually working with something that I love. And jokes aside, so it started off with a couple of really good friends, really close friends of mine, who actually were able to work with something that they loved. And so I decided to give that a shot. And that was either, how cliche it might sound for a guy saying it, but sports or music, right? So
sure.
So that was it. Yeah. And at that point, and they were in music, by the way. So I was close to people who had a professional career in music, and I was close to people who actually had a creative career in music. And it was this morning, epiphany moment. The sun was coming up over Ibiza. We were there for the summer with friends in a house, which is an island in the Mediterranean where there's a lot of music culture going on.
Yeah.
And I decided to make the move to actually go after, you know, money in fun in my matrix. It was like I was living money in boring and miserable. And I said, okay, I'll compromise on the money if I can work with something that drives me passionately. And it wasn't only a romantic move, by the way. You know, you remember 13, 14 years ago, something was cooking, right? The music industry was changing right in front of us, not only in terms of consumption, but production, distribution, and consumption at the same time. So the whole business model was in movement. So there was a rational thought. So everything I did, from education that I put in, professional training with different firms on, you know, management consulting, private equity and stuff, I used to progress myself into the music industry. And there was basically only one way, because it was a terrible time for the industry in terms of the numbers, but it was a perfect time to take a step in terms of future opportunity with streaming coming. So the only way of actually going after it was creating your own company. And so we did. We created, I created my first startup in the space called Tonium. And we actually set out to build the first human-driven music recommendation engine. So, but it was way too early. But answering your question, all of the professionals' moves in terms of education as well as professional experience was obviously there to set me up for something that I really wanted to do. I just didn't know what it was, but now I have the opportunity to go after it.
So when you start looking at your transitions, like your experience with Beats Music, Spotify Business, where are the similarities in those roles that and moving from one to the other as far as what you were wanting to accomplish and what you wanted to bring and what you wanted to elevate? What were those similarities, but then what was that thing that you felt was missing out of those opportunities?
That's a really good question, because there is actually one thing that I sometimes say that I'm still doing the same thing that I did 14 years ago when making the decision to move into the music industry. And it's based on this initial thesis that doesn't sound very spectacular today, but back then it was kind of challenging. It was the thesis that the music market is going digital and there's nothing that's going to stop that progression. Right. That means that sooner or later, consumers and any music users will have access to all the music in the world at their fingertips, anywhere, anytime. That's a statement from 14 years ago, from me to myself.
Which you could be saying that today, and it's still, you know, the way I hear that, and I listen to it, and it seems so, back then, it was a little bit of a cutting edge statement of realization of how big it was going to be, having foresight into how big it was going to be. However, you could say the exact same thing today in the sense that it's not going to be the same 5 years from now as it is today. There's going to be something different that is elevating it. So that statement from 14 years ago and having such huge foresight into how big it was going to be, you could say the same thing today, and there's still going to be those tweaks that elevate and differentiate one business, one stream, one something from the other.
Completely. I 100% support that. Sometimes people tend to think it's all over again and like, okay, we're here and, you know, but we're, you know, this is just the beginning. So even 14 years ago, it was a bold statement. I mean, people were absolutely not on board with streaming. It was file sharing, and Spotify started up in a basement in Stockholm, and so forth. So back to your question, the repetitive thesis in all my startups have been, if there is a market of abundance of audio, then the company or person or function that actually helps select and distribute the right audio to the right place to the right time will be a very interesting component. So curation, if you may, but, you know, scalable selection support or programmatic content to stimulate you as a specific human being or the specific business that I'm working with now. So I set out to do that, and I've done it in different iterations throughout my career. And obviously, yes, today we have fairly advanced, scalable AI machine learning driven functions around that, but it's still not solved, right? And it's,
right.
And there's so much more market around the world, and there's so much more monetization potential for music creators with their art, and it's only just begun.
Right. And only just begun, and it's, you know, we deal with a lot of musicians with Interstate Music, and having up and coming artists come through and play in our event space, and we share and elevate musicians' new music and new projects and what they're up to. And every time I talk to an up and coming musician, they're still missing and trying to figure out, how do they monetize? How do they get heard? How do they maintain some larger percentage of what they're personally creating and still get it heard and not have it gobbled up by, you know, the big, whether it's the management teams, and I'm not trying to make anybody into some ogre of a business model. It's they do their thing and they want to be compensated for it. But where is it for the musician coming up, and in a social world that's so cluttered, and everybody's like, oh, it's so great because we can reach everybody in the world through social media, but it's so cluttered. So how do they differentiate themselves? How do they get to where they are? And what do you think about that insight? Do you break it down to like the musician's viewpoint into this? And is that kind of what your basis of where things are going to move forward? Or is it more the consumer of the streams?
Well, so let's take a half a step back. So the reason why I get up in the morning and don't feel, you know, darker and darker and cynical,
yeah,
is the fact that I'm not solving cancer at all, but I am actually, I have been repeatedly done something good, and that is constantly striving to increase the ability to monetize music. So I'll stand up to that statement any day of the week. And that makes me feel good because I'm maybe not paying the rent as of today, but some of my startups are paying some of the rent right now. And sure, this new one that I'm doing is nothing less than just, I'm taking music streaming to the business markets. And that is a very low hanging fruit for additional revenue for music creators and all the people in the value chain. So it's something good. I think we can add, Soundtrack Your Brand, my latest startup is about, you know, business to business streaming, meaning the coffee shops, the restaurants and so forth. We'll talk more about that later. But that is, once again, a part of the streaming economy that's coming with all the downsides that you mentioned, the clutter, so many artists out there, anyone can distribute, it's seamless, but it's actually adding some value to it. And that's good. I'm not just cutting up the value again from some other angle. I'm actually adding, you know, something on top. And that's the first important statement. It needs to keep growing the total cake in order for the cake pieces to become bigger as well.
They have to become bigger for the musician, or they're just going to realize they've got to go get another job, and their creativity of writing new music and launching new music and the ability to make money doing that is going to go away to the point where they're just going to say, I guess this is just a hobby when I play every once in a while on weekends. And we've got, you know, there's aspects of, you know, if we love our music in our life, which everybody does, to the point where you're talking about business to business, you know, opportunities in music, it's so much a part of who we are and what we wake up to and how we get through those days, how we connect to things. So we've got to try to figure out a way to have musicians feel as though they're doing something that has a value for them personally instead of everybody else. And they're just, you know, some small piece to the puzzle for somebody else to make money off of them. So it's those challenges. When I see it, I look at it and I look at, you know, I look at Spotify, I look at some of these other streaming sides of it. And, you know, I think you're right when you talk about the low hanging fruit, because when I read Spotify Business, I immediately went, what exactly was that role? What did that mean? And what were you trying to accomplish? Can you go through a little bit when you were in the world of Spotify, which everybody knows Spotify, you know, they've got their accounts, they've got their playlists, they've got everything. And that's what they're listening to in their office. But when it comes to Spotify Business, what was your, What was your goal? What was the purpose of that? And what did that mean to Spotify?
Yeah, so it connects to my previous statement. I came from the business to consumer streaming world, and I was on your side of the pond.
Yeah,
doing it together with Jimmy and Dre, and we all know where that led to Apple.
Right.
So I learned a bit about the streaming market, and what happened the whole time was that people from big US corporations mainly would reach out to us and say, "Hey, how do I use, you know, how can I get music in my business? How can I get, Starbucks, McDonald's, General Motors, whatever, you know, would come to us.
Here's where I'm confused. Can't you just take and start an account with Spotify and you create your playlist and you play it?
It would be the equivalent of opening a cinema on a Netflix account. That's the easiest way of explaining it.
That's a great way to explain it. That made perfect sense in my head as soon as, okay, all right, now I understand.
If you're representing the music industry or a music creator, you're not, you know, you want to get paid more if someone's using your art to sell more coffee. And no one could really argue, because I didn't invent the concept of public performance or actual,
right,
you know, commercial licensing. That's been around since the 20s. So there is this IP related reality of, if you're using background music or whatever you choose to call it, music in business, you should be paying more because it's there for a commercial reason, which is great. The problem with, and I'll answer your question first. So Yes, I was on the consumer side. I got a couple hundred questions. I had never done business to business in my life before. And I started, you know, it started sticking in my head, like, what's going on here? People are asking me. And then I realized that, wait a minute, everywhere I walk into a coffee shop in Santa Monica, right, or, you know, my favorite, you know, bar here in Stockholm, there's music playing.
Right.
And sometimes it's great and sometimes it's terrible. And right, the people who actually play great music, you know, I come back. And right, I stay longer, and my buddies out of there, and we're, you know, buying drinks, and so.
I owned a sports bar back in my day. I owned a sports bar, and I had more customers back in the mid '90s. I had more customers that would tell me, "You've got the best jukebox in town," and that was why I was getting customers coming back and spending more time, because I had the best jukebox in town. So your concept of what you're saying is so spot on, but you don't, as a business, so many times you don't think about what that impact is to your business, to the consumer that's walking in, and how you it's customer retention when you've got a establishment
but
where
they do
going to sit there. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But the reality is, so I started reading up, and first of all, I understood, hey, there's the streaming licensing deals we did at Beats and at Spotify have actually not been done for background music. That's interesting.
Yes.
So hence, there are no streaming services licensed for background music. So then I said, wait a minute, there might be something interesting here. And then I started looking at it. It was a complete broken legacy market where these big service companies were completely exploiting music creators, not paying anything, shipping CDs, using society-based licensing where they're not even reporting what's being played or remunerating according to playback. It was just broken.
Right. I would have licensing companies show up at my bar with a clipboard and saying, hey, you owe us $400 for playing these CDs out of your jukebox. So cut us a check for $400, or we'll, you know, you're at risk of being sued or this and that. Like, and I'm like, $400, that's crazy. Okay, how about 300? It was so ridiculous on how, but they were, there was this weird face-to-face attempt of trying to get money from me to get licensing for the CDs that were in the jukebox that I was playing in a business establishment, but it was so choppy, so broken, so non-trusted. It had no idea what was going on. Didn't even know if this person was legit that was walking
right
in.
And even if she or he was, how the hell would they know what you were playing? And how the hell would they
how
be
often?
Able to, you know, pay the royalties to the right composer in Nashville?
Exactly.
So it's like they're collecting, but they're not redistributing. anyways, like I can, don't get me going. Cause So I found a piece of the music industry that was broken.
Yeah.
But I found a market where the entrepreneurs, bar owners love playing music because, you know, 90% of them in the world, there's 128 million potential venues in the world to service. Yep. 90% play music already. So we don't have to reinvent any type of behavior. They're just playing music from a broken source or from the wrong source.
Right.
And obviously it's pretty interesting to have a consumer account, right? Because you can play all the music in the world. And it's amazing. The problem is there was no license. So of course they'll use a consumer service. Maybe sometimes with zero ill intent and understanding, and sometimes with a calculated risk.
Yes.
But if the music industry, once again, to your point, if more people are trying to make a living by being music creators, because we are nothing without the music creators, like every DSP or distributor or middleman should always remember, we are nothing without them. So our job is to actually fertilize their life and give them, you know, enough to pay the rent and live their creative, you know, lives. So I said, okay, maybe I can fix this market. Maybe I can actually monetize it correctly. And maybe I can actually put it on the digital value chain, meaning that I can pay the songwriters at the end of the day or the artists at the end of the day on a usage basis.
Because you can track, because when it's digital, you can actually track how often a certain song is being played. If they're doing it on a rotation, what are the hours of operation and how many sequences of their 90-minute rotation?
They should get paid.
Yep.
So what's the other solution? Shouldn't they get paid, or should someone else get paid? Should John Bon Jovi get paid when my tracks are, you know, it's ridiculous in the 2020s.
Yep.
They should be fairly compensated when their music is used in a commercial environment, and they should be richly compensated.
Doesn't that also give the ability for a musician or a management team to go to, you mentioned Starbucks, go to a Starbucks and say, hey, we've got a new artist. We would really love for them to be part of your, you know, in business rotation. We want to send some. Is that a thing that is part of this potential mix?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, we launched 2018. It's the first time that background music is on the digital value chain. So hopefully artists are starting to see some royalties come through on the royalty statement. Otherwise, all the artists listening, ask your label, ask your publisher, where's my B2B royalties? Because your art is being used in a commercial context. So that's the first kind of thing. And then I want to say, like, if you're super pragmatic and working in the music industry, which I've come to become, it's like the music industry is about two things: making money and breaking artists, right? Yep. So that's kind of how the industry people think. And background music actually provides both. We're charging $50 a month for our on-demand subscription for business. That's not too much for a bar owner in you know, New York or whatnot to pay for great music and, you know, be able to create your own playlists. So come on, man, like 50 versus using, you know, a consumer account, like it's only $40. You can absolutely, I think the artists are worth it.
I totally agree with that, because then you're in a situation where you actually know what you're doing, why you're doing it, and then you can start to create your playlists, because you know that what you're paying is actually going to get tracked and the artists that you're playing are actually going to get royalties from it. So there is a situation where if you happen to know up-and-coming artists and you want to lend your establishment more towards, you know, those types of musicians, and you want to kind of be – you can then start to promote the fact that we're this company, we're this bar – you know, we play up-and-coming artist music that you might not hear anywhere else, you know, blah, blah, blah. You can start to use it as a marketing tool as well for your establishment.
Yeah, and that was the other point. So the music industry, making money and breaking artists. So that's the other thing. I mean, in the U.S. standalone, I just have some fresh numbers from MRC Nielsen that I ran. There's 91 billion store visits. So you guys are in and out of shops multiple times every day in a normal world. Let's just take the luxury of looking beyond COVID, right?
Yep.
So every potential, you know, store visit is a potential music discovery moment. And you know what? Actually, 79% of consumers actually register what's being played. So back the notion of background music doesn't exist anymore. It's actually foreground music. So all of a sudden, you start thinking about this old, you know, boring channel background music. And then, wait a minute, it's actually huge. It's way bigger than Roblox.
It's not
bigger than Fortnite.
Yeah, it's not elevator music. You know, back in the day, you hear this elevator music where you get in an elevator and they just have this, you know, soft whatever music. You don't even know what it is. Mm-hmm. You go up and down and it's just something to kind of calm people while they're in a maybe a nervous, claustrophobic situation. This is actually...
Yeah, that's where it came from.
Yeah, this is relative music. This is relevant. It's now. It's trending. So it's going to keep. It's going to catch somebody's ear because they've probably heard it before, and it's going to put them in a mood, which you'd rather. And music typically puts somebody in a good mood, but it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of it. I'm unlocking this no-brainer value for the music industry, and it's completely broken today, and it feels good because. $50, you know, a great bar owner in you know Santa Monica or Brooklyn or Nashville. I mean, they're an integral part of their customer experience is the music. I mean,
it is.
Come on, every place, you know. And if we empower them to do it, they're happy to pay it. And you remember when you had your bar? Imagine if actually I came in and said, "Hey, look, $50, not $300." And you know, I'll guarantee you, every track that you play, we're remunerating her.
Right.
Or him.
Right. And that's
that would have been the right, you know,
service. And that's such a different mindset, especially if you know, if you are a somebody that started this business, you understand that everybody is part of starting their own business and helping others with their business to actually monetize and actually have a chance to grow. Mm-hmm. It's in us all. So here's a question for you that kind of, you know, stumps a lot of people, especially if you're a business and you're using, you know, video content is so important. Audio and video content on social media is such a big deal. As a business like Interstate Music, right? For us to use anybody's music on a social platform, it's like jumping through hoops to try to figure out some level of licensing and who owns the licensing for this song or that song. And can we put this as our background music for this video that we created? Where does that fit into what you do? Or is that a completely separate bucket?
No, it's still kind of, what I do is I'm trying to build a full service platform for businesses. And so, but I'm starting with the most evident part of it, which is, you know, customer interfacing businesses, bars, restaurants, retail, salons, yep. whatnot, because it's the easiest first use case and hasn't been done yet. So I got to, you know, take one little part at a time. And it's a huge market, by the way. I can probably keep going on that until I retire. But
sure.
The ambition is to be able to serve all businesses with this. And it's super, I mean, if you run a bar, you're more educated because you come from a music background, but like you're a bar entrepreneur in Stockholm, you have no idea what licenses you need. It's impossible to figure it out because it's
it's legit, you know, it could be completely legit, but if it doesn't feel legit to you, you feel like you're getting scammed and taken advantage of. And the way you're presenting it is so logical and so clean and it's a real business aspect of licensing and the rights that musicians have to monetize on that. Like you were saying, I wish I was explained it that way. And I think when you look at it, you're going to have more and more people that buy into the reality that that's a thing and it won't be a challenge. You could send a simple email blast or a video content and put it out there explaining this in all of 4 minutes. I mean, it's that simplistic concept.
And so back to like doing background music first. So I'm digitizing background music, fixing the broken background music. But then obviously there's this, as you said, like, okay, I want to put some music on a local ad or I want to do something on Facebook or social
media. Right.
That's another huge problem where like, once again, the music industry trips themselves up by creating so much complexity. I mean, wouldn't they rather want to monetize that than some stock music provider? I actually just had a long lunch with a good buddy of mine called Oscar. He runs a company called Epidemic Sound, and it's the biggest kind of stock music provider in the world. It's out of Stockholm as well. And they're on fire. Like, they're solving that problem for YouTubers. They're solving that problem for Twitchers. They're solving that problem for everyone. Like that, because the, wouldn't that be interesting for you know, the smaller labels or the,
just, sometimes, you know. I feel like there's a reason they don't want it simplified, because they make it so difficult. We did a Christmas special, you know, with an artist that came in and was, were singing like, you know, Christmas songs that everybody knows and loves. And we did video around it, and we were up against such a challenge trying to find who had the licensing rights to White Christmas. You know, it's like, and then to get like, what does it cost for us to be able to put it out there and not worry or be in fear that it's going to get pulled down or we're going to get some fine or something? Like, it's so challenging, and it seems like it could be so clean and everybody would get their piece.
I think just, and I honestly think, I mean, the music industry is full of smart people. So yes, I think there's no real aggregated like industry organization being able to like approach this big challenge of publishing rights, label rights, sync rights. I mean, it's practically, you know, fixing the sync market, what we're talking about, and scaling the sync market. I'm starting with scaling the background music market. Yep. And I am by no means even close to, you know, getting to first base even, but I see the path. After right. that, I want to scale the sync market.
Yeah. And that's, hopefully that's sooner than later for my personal reasons, but
I really want you to guarantee it.
Come on, dude. Help a brother out here. So tell me, you know, when you talk about soundtrack, you know, your brand, is it all about like how many artists, how are you going about this? What is the platform? What's the technology behind it? Tell me all about it. Hit me.
Sure. I'll connect to where you kind of put me last time, was what were you doing with Spotify? So I moved back home after a couple of 100 questions to Stockholm and with an idea to start like a streaming service for the business market. And I checked out from my US buddies, moved back home for family reasons. Yeah, I was completely broken by sitting on a plane around the world like 250 oh, yeah. days and just exhausted. Yeah. Anyway, I got back on the saddle, walked over the street to Daniel and Martin at Spotify, the founders, and said, and everyone knows each other. We're like this small town in the Midwest here in Stockholm. And it's like, hey, I'm gonna start a streaming service for the B2B market. They said, oh, this sounds cool. Let's do it. You know, we'll pitch in. And I said, I need to use your backend because like I just went through the pain of building a music backend in 3 years and with the $30 million put into it. So that's fine. Let's do it. And we started, I started the Soundtrack Your Brand company as with an ambition to build an independent company, obviously. But I had this little start version where we did Spotify Business first together yeah. to test the concept. Is there a market for streaming for business? So they pitched in their back end. They did some initial licensing for Sweden, Finland, and Norway for us, just test licensing. And I built the first kind of customer interfacing product. So, yeah, and I usually use this analogy. So if Spotify's building the car, I was building the truck. And because I'm the B2B, you know, yep. so I'm selling to companies, right?
Yep.
And it's completely different. You know, it has 6 wheels and it has, you know, maybe even 18 wheels in some instances. And it, yep. you know, I'm selling to procurement departments or business buyers, and it needs to carry other things and it needs to be bulletproof and stuff. So it's a completely different product, but we're still shipping the same, you know, art, music.
Yeah, right.
So we investigated that, launched Spotify Business in Sweden, Norway, and Finland. And very quickly, I realized, holy shit, this actually works. This is like, there's a market here, part of my English. But
yeah,
that's what I said. And so that gives some context. Then I decided, okay, I want to move away from home. I want to do what I initially wanted to do, which is build my own company and my own brand again. And Daniel and Martin were totally cool. That's the way we decided to. So then I started the small trivial exercise of doing 16,000 licensing deals with labels and publishers again, because I realized that this had not been done. Right. So I had to do the equivalent work that they did for the consumer market, but for B2B. So I had to architect the streaming model for business-to-business streaming, meaning who's going to get what, what's it going to cost, what tiers and everything. So that was a nightmare, obviously. That took me 5 years.
Right.
And 2018, we rolled out the first markets, had moved away from home, had our own little beautiful brand, and Soundtrack was alive and kicking and ready to go.
Unbelievable. The fact that you had grown through your different career paths, different, you know, stops in your, you know, in your career, and the friendships that you built to the point where, you know, you built true friendships in your career that you could, you know, lean on those during times of, you know, kind of repurposing some of the experiences that you had to a new idea. I think that's where so many people get lost along the way when they're going job to job to job, where they're constantly, you know, leaving a job because they want to leave the job, and they kind of, you know, you hear about burning bridges all the time, and it's just like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to do this for myself, or I'm going to go do this for the other company. So much of what you've done and grown into, it seems like you're still so connected with everything that you were doing and everybody that you were doing it with, that it seemed like it was more of a group of people that wanted to help you get this idea going. Is that fair to say?
I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, look, the music industry isn't that big. We're merely distributors, and we need to always remember that. We build technology to serve up the creative arts, and we're only, you know, we're only the middleman in terms of that. And in that market of what is defined, you know, DSP, digital service providers, there's not a lot of people, you know,
right.
there's maybe 100, 200 people that actually call the shots. And I'm also talking about people who do the deals on label right. and publisher side. So,
right.
yes, I mean, and it, you know, what comes around goes around. You do business with people that treat you well and live up to their promises and so forth. And I've seen that even in this industry. So if the cause is good and you've done good with other people before, you get some help on the way for sure. I got some help on this one because I really needed to see if this worked first. And then I was able to fund it and move away from home and build our own little company. But answering your first question, we actually distribute over 55 million tracks in 75 markets, which is the equivalent of Apple or Spotify, right? Almost. I wouldn't say we have full coverage, but more or less it's the perception. So I can almost guarantee any music creator that I'm representing them on a premium level in any market.
And how do you go about getting those agreements and those deals with those licensing and, you know, teams and those management teams and those musicians? How do you actually grow in that? Like if I had 35 up and coming artists that wanted to be part of your mix, do they have to go through a certain channel, or do they just simply reach out to you? How do you grow who you represent?
Well, I mean, the way it works is just
you don't want to
like
grow by
Spotify,
five
Apple,
musicians
Amazon.
At a time. Yeah.
I mean, what you do is you set like a licensing agreement with a publisher or a label or like a local rights organizations, and then you have the right to actually distribute their art, their music. And then comes the beauty of actually packaging that, you know, the right music to the right brand at the right time. So all of the above is possible. I mean, our job is to help the entrepreneur running the bar or running, yes. you know, the saloon or the restaurant group in Chicago to quickly get like super cool music at the right place at the right time to drive, you know, sell more pasta or more drinks or something. So that's really my job, is helping the restaurateur. But at the same time, I'm unlocking this value for the music industry by charging 50 instead of 10 or 5 where the consumer market is. So there's this, you know, I'm very well welcomed in the music industry now because I'm actually one of the few creating a tangible, you know, clear path to
right.
extracting more value from music. It's $50 and it's B2B. Great. I mean, your sports bar, I don't know back when you had that, if you actually were paying Fox or whoever you were paying for showing sports, but that's not cheap.
Right. I mean, if you wanted to have a pay-per-view Mike Tyson fight at a bar, it's based on your capacity. It's like all of these things built into it. And it really did. It really was kind of a pain in the ass. I mean, it seemed like it was overpriced. You didn't even think that they had a system in place that really made sense or fit everybody. You know, you'd have, if you had a capacity of 300 just to show a pay-per-view fight, it's astronomical what you were paying, to the point you had to start charging cover charges for people to come in, when all you were really trying to do is have a bunch of people come hang out, watch a fight, you know, on a couple of TVs. It seemed so difficult. Yeah. But
remember what you're actually saying here. So the sports industry obviously figured it out, right? So yes. You want to show the Premier League in England or anywhere in Europe where soccer is big. I mean, it's going to cost you $30,000, $40,000 a year. I'm assuming the same goes for NBA, NFL, through Fox or whatever. That just mean. But the entrepreneur does the business case and says, it makes sense because I'm filling the bar and they, you know, calculate it. I mean, the sports industry figured it out. The film industry figured it out because no one's opening cinemas on Netflixes. But the music industry, they didn't figure it out. They're still, you know, I just got Nielsen numbers now. Like 80% plus are still using consumer services. Right. And that means, you know, it's in the U.S. standalone, it's more than $10 billion on an annual basis. That value that's being destroyed because we can't fix this. Make it simple for the business owner, and they're actually willing to pay.
Well, I sit here and I listen to you. Make it. It's very difficult to do what you're doing. There's a lot to it, so I don't want to. I'm going to simplify this to the most ridiculous level. Okay, but when you talk about the partnerships and the licensing and what you built up to have your catalog of music and have those licensing rights for you to then resell it to these businesses for them to use. In that's the most simplistic way to explain this of how you're getting your product that you're able to go then sell to an exclusive marketplace, right? Why would that not transfer over? Because the technology aspect of what you're doing, the tracking and everything else on the B2B side, wouldn't be all that different for the e-commerce world of social media and all the rest of it, because that's still able to be tracked as far as what you're playing and all the rest of it. Is it really that much further down your line of going after it sooner than later? Because once you have those initial agreements on your catalog, to be able to share that with businesses that are putting social content out there, is it closer than it, you know, it might sound for you to be able to do that?
Yeah. Well, I live by a religion called focus. I know. And I got to get this done first. And I have I've just begun. I'm at 50,000 businesses today.
Congratulations. There's 100 million.
Yeah. So, and I know that everyone's playing music out there. And the bars and so forth. And and when this COVID thing is over and we're all out there dancing, having drinks again, there's going to be a renaissance, and I'm going to be sourcing the music and I'm going to be paying songwriters correctly. Right. So yes, it's not that far away if you would have unlimited resources. And
it's the building the team that's going to go out there and create the infrastructure to manage that process is really what the challenge is.
But also remember that we're in an industry that doesn't always act in a logical way, right? So it took me 5 years to pay them more money for B2B. But on this one, they're really being challenged by stock music providers and kind of what's referred to as royalty-free music, right? And who are just, you know, creating a seamless product for, you know, YouTubers or influencers. So they should be interested in it, and I'm happy to go after to solve that. But first I need to get the proper support of fixing this market, because right now it's dysfunctional.
It absolutely is.
The background music market.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing what you've been up to and what you've done and where you're going, because it is absolutely fascinating to me that there's so many. I mean, when you sit there and you're just a consumer of music and you're playing whatever you want, whenever you want, as you know, in your own personal life, and to have you out there realizing, you know, that, because that's a big part of what we care about. We care about the musicians elevating their music, elevating them the right way, and kind of letting everybody know they exist. I love what you're doing in the sense that you are really taking hold of caring about the monetizing correctly for the individual artists, because really the big artists are the ones that make the money. And then you've got everybody else that is trying to figure out what's next for them. And I really appreciate the fact that you've kind of taken those projects under your wing and put a passion behind it, and used your connections to make them aware that it was that it's something that needed to be done, and convincing those people that it needed to be done, and get the buy-in from them as far as that, the concept. That's a big deal. And there's, like you said, nobody was doing it. It's crazy for me to think that nobody was focusing in on some of these things. And I think it takes somebody with a lot of insight and a lot of, you're just a person that I can tell your brain just doesn't stop spinning when it comes to some of this stuff. So thank you so much for what you've been up to.
I mean, thank you. I mean, the most rewarding thing about this little project is when I get these emails, and I get them sometimes, like from an artist or someone, hey, I'm Annie from wherever, you know,
right?
Providence. And I, all of a sudden on my, I have a small contract with an independent label, and I get my streaming, you know, my royalty statement. And I see Soundtrack Your Brand. I was like, what is that? And I have this unproportionate number of streams and payback per stream. What are you guys doing? And this happens maybe not once a week, maybe twice a week.
Right.
Or maybe, sorry, every second week. And that makes me I always answer hey, look, we're doing this, and that's because we're charging $50, and that means that you're going to get more per subscription. And you know what? You should have it, because this, you know, this hairdresser in Munich is using your music to make the vibe be cool.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, thank you. And that's, you're welcome.
I love the meaning behind it, because that one example of what you just said is truly true, because you're understanding the tone and the mood and the consumer behavior that ties into the music industry. And that's a big deal. And I think that's something that, like you said, it was just not being paid attention to, and you brought it to the surface, and you brought a reality to it. And you should get more emails like that. And I think you will, as things get moving. And I want to make sure that we do everything in our part to, you know, let musicians know that you're out there doing this. We're going to do exactly that. We're going to, you know, tell everybody. We're going to feature it on our site. We're going to put it out on our social. We're going to communicate to every musician that we could ever possibly, you know, come in contact with, because this is a big deal for them, and it gives them a reason for what they're doing, and that their music's being heard, not just in a car, not just, you know, in their backyard or when somebody's going for a run, that somebody is using their music to set a tone, set a vibe, and a consumer behavior pattern. And I think it's just cool. The science behind it, the thought behind it, the passion behind it. Ola, thank you for being part of the Interstate of Music podcast and sharing your story, your company, your journey. And we want you part of the family. So stay in touch and keep us up to speed with what's next and what's new, because we want to share it.
Thank you for your support, and love what you're doing as well. And every artist or creator out there, ask your label, ask your publisher, where's my B2B money? That's you know, shouldn't be afraid of asking. Where's the money from, you know, the music being used in businesses? Because we know every business is more or less playing music.
Right. No doubt about it. Thank you, Ola. Enjoy. I appreciate you staying up late for the podcast. And we'll talk soon, my friend.
We will. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.